Welcome to the podcast. As a listener, you're invited to claim your comp pass for our next live full-day Software Oasis virtual AI event with the world's top B2B AI experts. By attending, you'll join our engaged community of founders and executives from over 200,000 leading B2B global organizations. AI won't take your place, but a competitor leveraging it to drive results will. Learn the latest in AI first Thursday of every month. Tap green button at softwareoasis.com or use show notes link to secure your pass. I'd like to welcome everyone to this week's edition of the Consulting Spotlight. I'm your host, Michael Bernzweig, over at Software Oasis, located just outside of Boston. And joining us from Knapp Labs, we have Derek Hales. He's the founder and located out in Arizona. His organization is the company behind data-driven mattress testing and reviews. So I was hoping you can shed a little bit of light for any of our audience that may not be familiar with Knapp Labs, a little bit about your journey and a little bit about what you do out there.
Sure, absolutely. So our journey kind of began really by accident. In 2014, my wife and I got married. We were sleeping on my old Innerspring mattress at the time, which we were ready to upgrade pretty quick. So we did the whole kind of in-store experience, going in-store, trying beds, and we found some we liked. The problem was they were all, you know, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, and we were pretty frugal people, still are pretty frugal, and more than that, we had no money to speak of. So we ended up taking a chance on these kind of the new online mattresses that were kind of just getting started at the time. We ordered one. It was okay. Not a great fit. We returned it, ordered another one. It was a little bit better. And then I kind of ended this sort of, you know, mattress shopping experience with, you know, kind of all these experiences and some notes and actual, you know, testing two different mattresses. And I kind of put all this up into a quick website, a little weekend hobby project, really. We did the website, we did some reviews, some comparisons, and the site just really blew up. Within just a few months, it was just crushing it. Had really replaced my kind of full-time income at the time, and we just had people continue to ask us to review more beds, test more beds. So we kept testing, kept reviewing, and here we are. A little more than a decade later, having tested, I think we're up to like 420 mattresses now, tested today. Crazy.
What a huge need in the market space, and amazing how, you know, no one had actually done this before at this scale.
Yeah, you know, when we were sort of in trying to, you know, find information on beds during our shopping process initially, there was just not much out there. What was out there was very sort of, you know, amateurish and just sort of, you know, one-off random reviews posted on forums and here and there. And certainly it didn't have the sort of, you know, the structure and the objectivity that my mind really craves when trying to make, you know, any decision that's, you know, more than even a few hundred dollars. You know, I would like to put some sort of quantifiable data behind it. And so in sort of the process of, you know, starting this sort of, you know, journey into, you know, testing and reviewing and writing comparisons and best of lists, and I really just wanted to create the resource that I wanted and that I would want today.
Yeah, and you know, at the end of the day, it's not like buying a pair of sneakers. I mean, it's something you're going to live with for years. I don't know what the stats are behind mattresses, but I'm sure you do. How long does someone typically buy a mattress for?
I think the U.S. average is something like 5 to 6 years. Higher quality mattresses are going to last more like 8 to 10 years, but many of these, you know, lower, you know, quality mattresses, stuff that's in that cheap sort of, you know, let's say $300-$500 bracket, you know, those can last longer, but usually those are the mattresses that are being replaced every, you know, 3, 4, 5 years.
Now, out of curiosity, I mean, sneakers, you know, that's something that, you know, you find the pair of sneakers you like, you grab them. Most guys, I'm not sure, myself, I don't know if you're the same way, but a lot of my friends are, you know, they'll find a pair of sneakers they like, and that's their sneakers. You know, as long as they're still available, they keep going back for the same thing. Is it similar with mattresses, or is it a very unique purchase every time?
I think it it can be similar. I think the maybe the challenge with mattresses is your times between purchases are often very long. I mean, even if it's short, it's still 5 or 6 years. And for many people, you know, it's like an 8 to 10, 12 year purchase. So even if you had a mattress that you liked initially, that mattress, in all likelihood, isn't available. Or if that is available still, the materials may have changed, the design may have slightly changed. Mainly. It could be better in some ways, but it could also be creating a different feel. And so it's one of those things that I think is really tough to, you know, always get like, all right, I'm always going to buy this bed because I know it's going to be available. Because the reality is, it's not likely to be the exact same bed by the time you're ready to make a purchase, you know, years down the road.
So when you started this as a business, it was really to fulfill a need that you had personally. It wasn't just an idea for a business. Had you had other entrepreneurial endeavors before this, or was this your first, you know, foray into the online world?
So growing up, I was always had some little side hustle as a kid, trying to make money, mowing lawns, picking up leaves, that sort of thing. And then in college, I had launched basically a blog that talked all about like a particular video game at the time. And I sold an ebook that was all about how to earn currency in that video game. And I sold that. So I was able to, you know, have sort of a little business and sort of cut my teeth in the world of, you know, content and website building and SEO. And, you know, was able to learn some of those skills in college and ultimately, you know, pay my way through school doing that. So I definitely had a little bit of experience, but looking back, I clearly had a lot to learn to really, you know, turn this into something that could be sustainable and built on a really, you know, strong foundation.
I love it. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I even look, you know, I started on the internet in 1998. So that's super early days. And, you know, we've seen a ton of change since then. But when you started NapLab, I mean, I think that was a whole other world from where we're at today. There were a lot of, you know, differences in the way people searched, a lot of differences in a lot of the search engines and the algorithms. And, you know, social media was just really coming into its own. Now, I mean, we've got a huge shift in terms of AI as a big transition. But when you started NapLab, what was the foundation that you used for the website?
So we've always built on WordPress. And so that's been sort of the foundation. That's what I had, you know, initially taught myself in college. And I was building my websites in college. And then I was, you know, just it made perfect sense, you know. And even today, I think WordPress still remains a really strong platform, despite some of the drama and the craziness going on with the founder and others in the industry. Yeah. It's still, you know, a robust platform. And, you know, as long as nothing too crazy happens on the founder front there, it seemingly is going to continue to be, I think, a great platform to build on. The community there, the support's there, the premium plugins are there, free plugins. There's just so much in the ecosystem.
Yeah, it's a very robust platform. And it's like a ball of clay. You can make it into whatever you want to make it into. And
absolutely.
And serve, yeah, any type of option. So for you, was there something that was like a surprise, you know, from when you launched the business over that first year in terms of, you know, was it what you expected, or did it take on a life of its own right away? Or,
well, certainly it wasn't what I expected. My initial aspirations were, I just wanted a little hobby project to do over a weekend or two to sort of, you know, remind myself how to build websites. I had, after college, I had let sort of my entrepreneurial businesses sort of just trail off, and I stopped working on them. I went to work for a large digital marketing agency. And so I spent 4 years there. And, you know, when you're doing, you know, sort of enterprise SEO for Fortune 100 type clients, it's interesting work, but it's also a lot of, you know, I create a document, I create recommendations, I hand those off to their development team, and they take it from there. And so the actual building and execution, like, those just aren't skills that you generally need working at an agency. And so I had felt like I had really lost those. And so this sort of weekend project was just to remind myself, all right, well, how do I build? How do I set up a domain? How do I, you know, do everything that's required to actually build a website, because I didn't want to totally lose those skills. And so the initial, you know, launch was just a fun project. And so the fact that, you know, within a few months, it was already making a substantial amount of money. And I'm starting to ask myself, oh, God, this could be a real business. So I think to answer your question, the surprise was that it became a business at all. And then one that was, you know, wildly successful. And I was, you know, having more fun and doing more interesting work, and felt like it was work that was actually, you know, having a real positive impact on society compared to what I was doing at the agency. And so it was personally rewarding, and also, you know, financially rewarding as well.
And I would have to imagine, you know, having started in the corporate world like yourself, you know, a lot of things do get compartmentalized. You know, every different portion of the organization works on something different, and you may not be involved, like you said, in the final end result, or even have any input, even though you clearly see all the data right there in front of you, and you know in your heart what the right way to go is. So probably a lot of control it brought back to you in terms of what you were doing. And I can only imagine in the early days, you know, I think to my wife, and, you know, if I brought home a bunch of mattresses and said, this is what I'm doing, I can only imagine the look on her face. How was that in the early days? Was that a point of contention, or was it at the point where money started coming in, it was okay?
It's kind of like boiling a frog. You know, I didn't just show up with, you know, 15 beds all at once in the apartment. It was just, you know, one and then two and then three.
My
wife was initially very hesitant, wasn't super in favor of me leaving my stable job to become a mattress tester.
Right. That's another thing, right? Yeah.
But by the time we got, you know, 6-12 months into it, she had, you know, she was on board. You know, she was seeing, okay, this is going to be a real thing, and he's committed and everything. So, our first, you know, apartment as a married couple was a, you know, one bedroom apartment, something like 930 square feet. By the time we were ready to move out of that, I had 17 king size mattresses in that apartment on a third story walk up. It was packed. The 60% of my living room was just a bookcase of mattresses from end to end. We had one little corner left where we still had the TV and the couch where we could sit, but the hallway, the kitchen, living, every room, we had mattresses stacked, I think up to four high on the actual bed frame, just because we had no room elsewhere. So
that's right within code, so don't worry about it. You know, that's how every business starts.
we filled that one bedroom apartment to the absolute maximum. And then I guess about a year after we had launched the website, we were able to then get our first house together, and we had a little bit more space, but it was only a few years later that we had done the same thing there, filled to the maximum.
Now, was NapLab the original domain name that you launched with, or did you transition at one point?
So my original business name was Sleepopolis. So that was our original website that we launched in 2014. I sold that one in 2017, and then we were able to get NapLab off the ground in 2021.
I love it. So really an interesting journey getting to where you are today. So, you know, obviously doing it all over the second time, you probably were at the point where you knew exactly what you did and did not want to do. Were there some different strategies that you used when you launched the second time around?
I think certainly knowing what works and what doesn't work, you know, I think when you're in any type of business where you're creating anything creatively, there is this sort of natural evolution and progression of, you know, just sort of the quality and the form and the excellence of whatever you're creating. And at least for me, I look back at anything that I've created really more than about 6 months back, but especially 12 months back, I hate everything that I've previously done, because it seems like it's just like this little, you know, slow improvement. But by the time you get 6, 12, 18 months down the road, it is a huge number of things that we are doing, you know, bigger and better with better efficiency and better quality, and just everything about the piece of content, be it contextual or image or video, is better and improved. So
yeah, it's, you know, an iterative process. Absolutely.
Exactly. So having, you know, years of mistake making, up to that point. By the time we launched NapLab, I had a really good idea in my head, like, this is what this is going to be. This is what it's going to look like. This, we're going to do things differently this way to, you know, just create something that is more robust. And so the biggest change really was the data-driven aspect of the review. So in the earlier days, the reviews, they had some data points, but they were still largely subjective. And I wanted to really flip that on its head, so there would still be some subjectivity, which I think is always relevant in any sort of, you know, piece of review content. But especially, we wanted to hit with as much objective, quantifiable data as possible. Take these things about mattresses that feel very subjective, very sort of nuanced, and really distill them down to numbers, so that black then we white. Can say this is better than this, or this mattress has, you know, 15% less motion transfer than this, and you can see the numbers and you can see the wave of energy. And it's not me just saying that has lower motion transfer. There are numbers, there are trends, there are clear data averages that we can compare back to and make really informed recommendations using that data.
So it sounds like the second time around, you were able to start with the end point in mind. You knew exactly where you were heading, exactly how to get there without having to go through that whole iterative process to get there. And you knew how to do it better. You just had to get it done.
Yeah, we were certainly much, much closer. We still made substantial changes. I think we started with our, you know, scoring system 1.0. We're now on scoring system 1.2. And so we try to, you know, keep all of the reviews at the same system so that they're easily comparable. And as we've sort of, you know, gotten, you know, further and further off the ground, we can see, okay, well, this is a better way to analyze this data, or this is a better way to score this data, so that we are properly creating the right sort of, you know, scores and assessment for, you know, mattresses by categories, essentially how they sort of, you know, fall on the curve, essentially.
So was data and analytics and all of that part of your formal training, or was it something you grew into, or are other people on the team really deep diving into data and analytics? Because it sounds like a really important component.
That's certainly not a part of my formal training. You know, I had a few, you know, statistics type classes in college where I got a business degree, but nothing major there. I think I had these sort of the ideas for how this comes together from a sort of scoring and testing perspective, but the real data genius on our team is my wife. She has a master's in mathematics and education, and she is truly incredible when it comes to making sense of our data and allowing us to essentially build tools and resources that give us a level of insight into the data that we previously didn't have, but perhaps most importantly, allow us to create content that is better, create content more efficiently, and create just, again, a level of assessment that would be impossible without sort of this suite of back-end tools that she's built for us.
You know what they say, behind every successful guy is a strong woman. And here we are on Valentine's Day. She is going to be happy to have heard this episode where you actually brought straight out to the forefront the genius behind the data. So that is really neat. And really nice to hear. So
absolutely, yeah. No, she really is incredible. The things that she has built and continues to build and refine, it's one of those things where it's taken us sort of like years to come up with the enough imagination to realize that some of these things are possible. And some of these we had technical limitations before that wouldn't have allowed us to do some of the things that we're doing now. But as you know, we brought new, you know, pieces of technology or services or software into sort of the fold of the business, or we just, you know, are better equipped mentally to sort of imagine different ways that we can use the data, different ways that we can, you know, create tools that can help sort of the broader team that we work with be more efficient, create things that are better and cooler and more interesting. It's been definitely a slow growth, but one where we've, you know, in the same way that, you know, on the creative side that, you know, we've improved our reviews and content, on the data side, you know, it has sort of, you know, slowly stepped up along with us.
So if you were to look at all of the traffic sources, because obviously traffic is at the end of the day, the make or break detail for any online retailer. or any online site or review site, you know, in terms of what you can do. How have your traffic sources changed from when you launched until today? Are they more diversified, less diversified? Where do they come from?
They are, I would say, less diversified today. And I think that's just a pattern of launch, at least in my experience with this site. When we launched, we had less traffic. And so the diversity was stronger because we were doing a lot of referral traffic from, you know, certain forums or social media. Reddit specifically has always been really big for us. Of course, organic and organic social as well, and direct are big as well. As we've grown, it's been, I think, really two sort of main streams that have pulled ahead. Organic SEO traffic is, of course, the big one. We're just, for now, a larger site that is respected and trusted by search engines, so we get a substantial volume of traffic from Google and other search engines. And then, two, just the NapLab brand has grown as well, and we have a really strong level of awareness. So people remember the name, they remember the colors, they remember my face, they remember our insane, you know, quantity of data. And it sticks in people's minds. So we do a huge volume of just direct load traffic, people just typing, you know, naplab.com into a browser. And then, of course, people, you know, searching for NapLab on search engines as well.
I love it. Yeah, and it's important. You know, there's obviously, if you tune into a lot of the SEO world and everything that you hear, you know, you hear all of the different, you know, good, bad, and ugly stories over the last several years of all these transitions that we've had. But have you seen much of that with NapLab or not so much? Or?
NapLab has been a tremendous beneficiary to sort of every major sort of organic algorithm shakeup. And so we've had, you know, a few weeks where it dipped a little bit before, sure, you know, returning to course. But outside of some small stuff like that, it's been, you know, pretty smooth sailing on that front. And, you know, I hope that is, you know, reflective of, you know, what we're doing. I think that the way we built the site, you know, tries to, you know, create something that really just isn't out there. And create a level of review that people like, that they read, that they want to share, that they want to, you know, come back to. And so far we've been very fortunate in that we haven't had any major downturns when it comes to organic.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, you have absolutely charted your own course, which is so important. I mean, I think you see so many organizations and copycat ideas and everything out there. But I think at the end of the day, doing something unique, if everybody's going left, you need to go right. I think that's the reality of it. And you just need to do your own thing and not look at the competition, not look at anyone that's out there, and just kind of set your course. I think that's a big part of, you know, getting to where you want to get to. Now, as far as, you had mentioned some of the different important factors that individuals are looking at when they're trying to choose between different mattress options. What if you were to kind of bullet point, you know, the biggest details that are important to consumers in choosing a mattress, what are they?
I would say number one, firmness. Number two, price. Number three, materials. Those are the big three. And so, when it comes to firmness, you know, that one's pretty straightforward. You know, we all generally have a pretty good idea of if we want a soft, medium, or firm. And if you don't know, then you need medium. Something like 87% of sleepers out there are comfortable in a medium or medium firm mattress. So it works for the vast majority of sleeping positions and the vast majority of body weights and body types. So firmness is definitely a big one. Of course, price as well. You know, there are just some mattresses that are just not going to be available at a certain price, and including different, you know, mattress types and materials. So definitely, you know, spending as much money as you can to get a high quality bed, but at the same time, you don't need to spend, you know, $3,000-$5,000 in most cases to get a mattress that's going to work for you. Based on my testing, I would say that the sweet spot is, you know, let's say $1,500 to $2,000 for a queen size mattress. After that, you really start to see diminished returns pick up pretty dramatically. You're just sort of getting less and less And by the time you're at the 3K mark for a queen, diminishing returns is just plummeting. So there are very few mattresses on the market that are worth more than $3,000, at least based on my testing and my experience. And the third thing is just, you know, mattress sort of type and materials. And this kind of comes back to feel, really. And do you like the feel of latex? Do you like the feel of memory foam? Or maybe you just don't know what you like, what type you need, which is, you know, around 50% of people. If you're in that bucket, you know, going with something that is sort of even like a hybrid mattress that uses, you know, layers of foam on top of coils, creates a more balanced feel. So I would say those are really the big three things to consider.
Now, for individuals that are in the mattress market, I guess, or the market to buy a mattress, you're ready for your next mattress. How are they using the site? Are they going to the site, kind of zeroing in on what they might want to get? And then what do they do after that?
Yeah, I think, you know, most people arrive at the site having done a search for a particular brand model. They're looking for a review on X mattress, or they are looking for a comparison between two mattresses, or they've done a search for a best of list, you know, best mattress for site sleepers or best mattress for back pain. And so they are generally arriving at the site where they already have some sort of, you know, in something in their head. They know that they've seen these beds at least being talked about and discussed elsewhere or through advertising. And now they're sort of trying to narrow down that list. And so I think we have people using the site a lot of different ways, you know, but that's generally how people come. And then the journey beyond that, you know, they are now, sometimes they come and just look at one thing and they read the review and they saw the ads already. And now like, okay, yep, I've seen the confirmation. This sounds exactly like what I'm looking for. I'm going to buy that. Or they arrive and, you know, they read some of the reviews, comparisons, best of guides that we've written. And they say, all right, I'm not so certain of what I initially thought. And then they're sort of expanding their search before sort of, you know, whittling it down to a smaller set. And then lastly, you know, some people just go straight and use our mattress finder quiz tool where that, you know, they just answer a few questions about their, you know, needs, preferences, and budget. That goes straight to me. And then I email them back a personalized recommendation. And sometimes it's all three of those things. And so I think we try to make the site as usable and accessible and as easy to, you know, navigate as possible so that regardless of sort of where you're at in the sort of mattress research, mattress purchase process, we have the tools, the reviews, the content, and the resources to support.
So you've just gone over the top in terms of providing every last detail a consumer could need and then some.
That's our aim, yeah.
I love it. So if you were looking, you know, back, you know, over the years and even to this day, is there a handful of tools that you use in your business to get to the final end result of what you're providing to consumers that you just couldn't live without?
Yeah, definitely. Certainly, I think WordPress is the biggest and the best tool, if you will. And I would just sort of extend that to sort of the WordPress ecosystem. I am definitely not a developer. I know a large amount of HTML and CSS, and I know a little bit of PHP and a little bit of JavaScript. And so I can usually find something that is mostly what I want and then modify it to exactly what I want. And WordPress just does an amazing job of that. And again, the supporting ecosystem of the WordPress plugins and forums and tools and everything out there that allows me to build what I want to build without getting bogged down having to deal with, you know, a freelance developer or just a more sophisticated, you know, level of, you know, development and building. I can just find something that is basically already, you know, halfway to what I need and just massage it to get to ultimately what I'm trying to create. So definitely WordPress and the WordPress ecosystem, despite the shakeups in the last 6 months or so, I still think is the best platform to build on. Beyond that, and it maybe seems so simple, so pedestrian, but I mean, Google Sheets is such an unbelievable powerhouse,
right?
That yeah. Just in the last, like, I would say 2 years, we've really started to use it in ways that I could not have even conceived of before. And this is mostly thanks to my wife. I mean, she has, you know, help to get the ball rolling and really allow us to build these. So I think had my wife gone to school to be a programmer, she'd be crushing it. But she taught, you know, high school math, and she has a math background. And so kind of her first, you know, well, I say her first job, she taught high school for 7 years, and then she actually joined me at the agency where she helped in the accounts receivable department. Again, kind of like boring work, but work that she was able to then have a real need for Excel and Google Sheets as a method to expedite sort of processes and work more efficiently with data and numbers and just a large quantity of data. So while working at the agency, they had a 3-person team that became a 2-person team that became a 1-person team. All the work stayed the same. And she was the last man standing. And so she had essentially built a series of Excel tools and macros to automate the functions of these 2 people that had quit. And so she had all this really actionable experience building these tools and functions and macros and sheets to help manage data and processes more efficiently. And then she was able to slowly help, you know, us do that with NAPLAB once she had resigned her position there.
There you go. And I'm sure it was a day they won't forget. But at the end of the day, you know, I have to say that, you know, I'm big on process and procedure in every company that I've owned. And I think, you know, you really can't scale what you're doing or, you know, get to where you want to get to without adding more people unless you have the right process and procedure in place on the back end. So it makes a lot of sense. And I would agree with you, as simple as it is, you know, Google Sheets and the whole ecosystem around it really adds a ton of value for a lot of companies. And I'll throw in one more, something I think is going to be as much a paradigm shift for all of us. You know, the internet was probably the biggest shift in all of our lives. The whole idea of, you know, where things went from there was interesting. Obviously, AI, the next major advance. I think the next biggest advance that we're all going to see, which is happening right now, is AI coding. A lot of AI coding, no code, low code, AI coding tools, I think are going to really take a lot of organizations by surprise if they're not prepared for it. Because I think what's interesting is I think a lot of organizations, obviously you've got your branding down pat, but a lot of organizations see their code and their tech stack as their competitive moat or competitive advantage. And at the end of the day, with all of these AI coding tools, I don't think that's the case anymore. And I think branding is even more important to help differentiate your business and everyone's business from one another. And I think it's going to become really apparent to a lot of companies over the next few years. So I think that's important. When you're using automation within your business, what are some of the benefits that you see? Obviously, it's making the processes easier to deliver, you know, to your customers. But do you see other benefits like reduction in errors and things like that? Or what else are you seeing?
I mean, those are the big two. It is faster and it is less error prone. And those two things just scale across, you know, our entire, our business. You know, we don't have a huge team, but we have, I think we're up to 9 or 10 employees now. And so processes that used to take 2 and 3 days now take a day. Processes that used to take me half a day to QA and to go through and to make sure there's no errors and to fix stuff are now taking me 30 minutes. And so it's allowed us to not only create faster, but create with less errors, and just scale more. We could just get more done in the same number of hours. Things that would have taken us, you know, 3 times the amount of hours are significantly cut in half. And so we're just able to create more with the same number of hours each day.
So we actually, before the episode, took some questions from the audience, and I'd be remiss if I didn't at least ask you one or two. I think one of the biggest questions that I saw coming in over and over again and it's obviously something you've mastered, but maybe you could share a little bit behind the scenes. How do you ensure that your reviews remain unbiased and free from external influence?
So this is really the foundation of NAPLAB, and it's a fair question and it's a big question because we have to be beyond reproach in this area. So when I was coming up with the sort of idea for our tests and our data, I wanted to remove as much subjectivity and as much potential bias as possible so that we come in, we do our tests, we take our measurements, we take our photos, we take our videos, and then that data just goes straight into a sheet. And the sheet tells us the score. And the score tells us essentially what we're going to recommend and what we're not going to recommend. So much of the recommendation is just the numbers. And there is essentially a mathematical formula for every score. And the inputs from the data side tell us what that score will be. And then that score is assigned essentially a different tier of analysis. So we say, based on the data, it earned this score, and this score is assigned to this type of analysis because we know that this score lines up on the curve with all the other matches. Therefore, it's in the top 10% or it's in the top 50%. And based on that, you know, our recommendations need to follow this particular form. So we are insanely structured and rigid in our testing data collection and editorial processes. There's a number of reasons why we do it, but certainly a big one is that we want to not just tell people that we're unbiased, we want to show them, and we show them through just an absurd level of objective oriented testing.
And obviously the company's grown over the years, but what is your role like in the year 2025 versus what it was before? And what are some of the other positions within the organization today?
So I am founder and editor in chief, but that doesn't really mean a whole lot. I do a little bit of everything, and I help everybody do their job better and more efficiently. And so I am still the head tester, still the face on our videos, still the one that is sort of leading the charge there. NAPLAB is, in some ways, it is a mattress testing machine. So we try to test two mattresses each week. And the process for doing those includes, you know, testing, photography, videography, script writing, creating the actual written review, editing that, publishing everything. And so it's way more than one person can handle. And so we have two essentially testers and videographers that work alongside me. And so they are coming in to make sure things are getting filmed on time, managing the videography process, doing most of the actual testing and data collection, and then the actual sort of data analysis. So they collect the data, and then they go back to follow our process to see exactly, all right, how does this match perform based on the data we collected? And that essentially is all sort of prepared for me to then write my final analysis on the mattress using the data and using our tools, which help me basically understand how good or bad a particular bed is. We have my wife, of course, who is, you know, sort of the man behind the curtain doing all the real heavy lifting. And so she is often just working on sort of the next tool for us. And so she helped build the initial sheets and tools. And right now she's working on a Google Sheets tool that is going to take inputs from the sort of customized analyses that I write and the data to sort of programmatically create sort of a single copy paste from Google Sheets into WordPress that's going to then be personalized and customized with all of our data, all of the scores, all the customized analysis, and our photographs and videos as well, so that, again, our editors don't have to manually copy paste these sections and write these sections. So much of that will be automatically done. I guess the last two sort of major functions we have, then my sister, who also works with me, and she's been with me since 2017. She is sort of our editor, essentially next to me, and so all kinds of stuff is coming her way, and she's making sure it gets published and correctly positioned and formatted so that we can make sure everything looks beautiful. And then beyond that, we have four video editors that help to try to keep the video machine moving. So we have every person kind of focused on one little segment of really this big content machine.
Neat. And I'll wrap up by asking you two things. So as far as, you know, obviously you sit in a really unique position and perspective, how have mattresses themselves changed over the years? I mean, I see mattresses coming in boxes now. You never could have envisioned something like that. I also see lots of mattresses that are just tremendously, you know, cumbersome to move and to get from one place to another. So what are the major transitions you've seen?
Sure. I mean, if we go back, you know, 20, 25 years, you know, Innerspring was still, you know, basically the name of the game. We had Tempur-Pedic then, but, you know, they were still expensive and more of a niche purchase. If we look at kind of the last, you know, 10 years, it's been really the rise of sort of the direct-to-consumer sort of bed-in-a-box type mattress brands. And so as sort of material technology with respect to coils, foams have improved, and also the machinery to like compress, roll, and then vacuum seal the beds has improved. And FedEx, UPS, the ability to then, you know, actually ship those beds that are sometimes up to 125, 135 pounds, we have sort of all of these sort of factors coming together that have allowed the direct-to-consumer mattress brand to create a really high-quality product for significantly less than what a lot of the more traditional legacy sort of big mattress brands were previously doing. So, you know, we look back, let's say 2013, you know, let's say less than 1% of beds were being sold online. Today, you know, most estimates are somewhere around 50%. And that figure is likely to grow over time as, you know, older generations who are less accustomed to purchasing online are being replaced by younger generations who are more accustomed to buying things online. I think there's, you know, a reasonable expectation that we'll see the number of beds purchased online relative to in-store rise to, you know, 60-65%, maybe more. It's tough to say. I think there is still, you know, a purpose and a point for, you know, the retail experience, but for so many consumers, they don't care. You know, their expectations for their mattress, they just want something that good. And the idea of having to go into a physical store to pick it out is something they just don't want to deal with.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And where are mattresses made today, which is, you know, versus where they were made in the past?
You know, certainly within the U.S., they're, you know, made in mostly the same places. You know, we still have many of the same factories still building. Those factories, you know, look very different today than they did, you know, let's say 15, 20 years ago. But it's still a lot of the major players are still making beds. There is a, you know, a good chunk of beds that are made in China and made overseas as well. Certainly, you know, when you're looking at Amazon mattresses and other sort of super budget-friendly mattresses, any bed sort of inside of $500, the probability that was made overseas goes up. But there is still, you know, a lot of, you know, consumer preference for beds made in the USA. Mattress sellers and manufacturers recognize that. And so there's still a lot of that manufacturing happening here in the United States.
That's really neat. And that's encouraging to hear. Obviously, it's maybe one of the last American manufacturing happy stories. But have you had a chance to visit some of these factories? And did you kind of come away with some unique perspectives that you didn't expect?
Yeah, I visited a couple. They are really interesting. I think one, the size of the larger factories is still sort of, you know, mind-boggling. You know, these places being, you know, hundreds of thousands of square feet of, you know, warehouse and factory space is not uncommon. So there is a factory about 30 minutes away from me that has, you know, 650,000 square feet of space. It is a mind-boggling factory. And they do essentially everything there. They, you know, quilt their own covers. They pour their own foams. they coil their own springs. And so they're taking, you know, really raw materials, raw inputs, and have vertically integrated the entire thing. So, you know, you can literally start at one end of the factory and watch this bed go step by step by step before it finally is compressed and rolls out the door, you know, a few hours later. I should say a few hours later. That doesn't really count for the foam curing process. So, but they're doing everything there. And there are, you know, a number of factories, you know, just like that elsewhere in the country. So, where that's not possible, you know, you'll see factories that specialize in foam production, which foam is something that is, you know, a lot of brands don't do themselves because you can pour so much more foam than you can use. And so you have sort of, you know, foam pourers that will pour a bunch of different foams, they cure them, and then you send these gigantic, what they call buns that are, you know, 10, 12 feet high off to the mattress manufacturers, and they cut that up into the individual layers before, you know, using that and other components to build their mattress. So the it's really cool. It's really cool. And, I hadn't really considered the fact that it is kind of rare to see, you know, this sort of manufacturing still done in the U.S. And I think maybe part of that is just, you know, the mattress is, you know, it's a large product. So like shipping it, you know, overseas, while feasible for some brands, when you start to make higher end mattresses that are heavier, especially, that becomes, you know, more difficult to ship overseas and just makes more sense to try to build here if at all possible. So it is really cool that, you know, most of the manufacturing is still happening here in the States.
That's really neat. And, you know, I could honestly see your team taking a road trip across the country and, you know, visiting just a ton of different manufacturers and giving people a peek behind the scenes. I think that would be something that could easily go viral. So I think that's pretty exciting if you haven't done that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'll have to consider that. We do have one video on our YouTube channel where we did an in-depth walkthrough of the local factory I mentioned. So if you're interested in, you know, taking a look at least one factory, we've got that up on the site.
I love it. Well, I really appreciate the deep dive. I mean, I think this was a very unique perspective for a lot of the listeners of Consulting Spotlight, and appreciate you taking the time out. For anybody that is new to the channel, we have two other podcasts, Career Spotlight and Software Spotlight. If you want to keep up to date, just go to softwareoasis.com/subscribe, and we'll leave a link to Derek and everyone over at Nap Labs in the show notes for anybody that would like to reach out. I'm assuming it's the website is just naplab.com?
Yep, that's it. NAPLAB.com.
Perfect, perfect. Well, I really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Software Oasis Podcast Network. With more than 200,000 listeners each month, you're invited to join our engaged community of B2B founders and executives at our next live full-day Software Oasis virtual AI event with the world's top B2B AI experts. Reserve your comp pass today. Get ahead with real AI strategies. Join the first Thursday of every month. Tap green button at softwareoasis.com or use show notes link to claim your spot today.